Good afternoon or good morning to those of you in the West. Welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Carrie Beasley and I will moderate today's seminar. Today's topic is engaging the private sector. Before I go any further, I do want to let those of you who are calling into the teleconference for the audio know that you need to mute your computer speakers or else you will be hearing your audio over the computer as well. Today we will have four presenters: Ms. Suzanne Rhodes from Wilbur Smith Associates, Nicole Katsikidis from the Maryland Department of Transportation, Karen Schmidt from the Freight Mobility Strategic Investment Board, and Liz DeRucci from the New Jersey Transportation Planning Authority. Suzanne S. Rhodes, AICP, is a principal and senior project manager with Wilbur Smith Associates, a wholly owned subsidiary of CDM. Suzanne possesses over 35 years of experience in transportation and project management. Prior to joining WSA/CDM, she served as Ohio DOT's Central Office Planning Administrator and as the Executive Director of BHJ, a multi-state MPO, and a LLD for Appalachian Regional Commission. While at ODOT, she helped develop and authored a number of planning documents, including the first ODOT statewide freight plan. Nicole Katsikidis is the Director of the Office of Freight and Multimodalism for the Maryland DOT. She oversees freight policy and planning, along with high-speed rail programs efforts for MDOT. Nicole's background includes freight and logistics management for the U.S. Air Force, economic development, planning, and infrastructure development for the states of Georgia and Maryland, as well as transportation policy initiatives. Karen Schmidt became the director of the Freight Mobility Strategic Investment Board in November 1999. She was selected as the first director to create and manage the Freight Mobility Program as an independent state agency. Prior to her selection as director, Karen served 19 years as a state representative, primarily focusing on transportation issues. She was chairman of the House Transportation Policy and Budget Committee for 5 years and chairman of the Legislative Transportation Committee for 4 years. Liz DeRucci is a principal planner at the New Jersey Transportation Planning Authority. 4 years ago, she joined the Systems Planning Division of the NJTPA and currently works on the Air Quality Conformity and the Transportation Clean Air Measures TCAM initiative. USDOT has recognized the TCAM effort as a national model of success for the innovative partnerships and projects that have been implemented with demonstrative air quality benefits. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers, and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the chat area. Please be sure you send your questions to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during the presentations, but I will start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. If we run out of time and are unable to address all questions, we will attempt to get written responses from the presenters to the unanswered questions. The PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within the next few weeks, along with a recording and a transcript. I will notify all attendees once these materials are available online. One final note, the Talking Freight seminars are available for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you are attending with a group of people, you must type your first and last name into the chat box. I have included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits after the seminar. At this point, we are still working on getting it up onto the AICP calendar for the credits, but we will let you know when those are available so that you can go online and sign up for the credits themselves. We will send out an email to everyone who registered once it is available online. Please also download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit this form to me after you have filled it out. We are now going to go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is freight and engaging the private sector. As a reminder, if you have any questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box and they will be answered in the last 30 minutes of the seminar. Our first presenter will be Suzanne Rhodes from Wilbur Smith Associates. Suzanne, you may begin.
Thank you. Am I on mute or can you hear me?
Everyone can hear you.
Great, thank you. I was asked by FHWA to provide an introduction to the topic and a small overview of the topic. It's based on the tools that we help prepare for FHWA Office of Freight Management and under the Freight Professional Development Program. The tools that they've created and what I'm going to be speaking of about our a guidebook for engaging the private sector in freight transportation planning, and there's a one-day workshop available through FHWA. At the end of my presentation, I have links to the internet on where you can download the guidebook and how you could schedule a workshop. These were built on the NHI course in integrating freight into the transportation planning process. They're sort of the next step. I believe that course is still available online for a nominal fee. I haven't checked lately, but I believe it's about $50. What we're going to cover today and what's covered in the guidebook in considerably more detail and the workshop are why engage the private sector, who to engage, how to engage them, and what to expect. Before I begin, I just want to sort of set an overarching statement. Engaging the private sector is basically public involvement. I have a little guy in the bottom corner here with his mouth zipped in 2 ears. Those of you that do public involvement frequently understand that it's not just about informing people. It's not just about you talking to stakeholders. Certainly that's part of it, but it's also about listening, and he's got 2 big ears, and it's about hearing what the freight stakeholders have to say. It needs to be an early and continuing process, as we all know that do a lot of work in public involvement. If you recall, a few years back when environmental justice sort of became a big hot topic and people focused on how do you engage a handicapped community, for example, people had to think a little bit more about how you would do this, what are their special needs, how would you engage them more actively. Same thing is true of engaging the private sector. Same principles, same approaches, you just need to think about what would work better. So you all have in your toolbox the tools to do this. Judging from the list of attendees and looking down the names, I know many of you, and you understand why you would engage the private sector in your planning process. You understand that there's a link between freight and the economy. A lot of people say freight is the economy in motion. If you look at each of the trucks on the right-hand side, not only is there a person with a job driving that, but it's full of products that will go to market and somebody will sell them in a store or use them in a manufacturing process. So there's a definite link between the economy and freight, and you want to, from what I hear when working with governments around the country, everybody is about jobs and how do you get more jobs. So improving the quality of life of people is about getting the products to market more efficiently, keeping the costs down so everybody can benefit, and you go into the grocery store and the milk's there when you want it and the loaf of bread is there when you need it. Certainly trucks have a different role and relationship to capacity and congestion on the roads. You need to understand that and work with them. And most important, freight is your customer too, just like the bike trail groups. The freight community is a customer of every state DOT and MPO and local government. What can they offer you? Certainly an understanding of their perspective. What's important to a truck moving down the road may be a little different than what's important to a soccer mom getting to her child's game. The reliability and predictability of the traffic, as you all know. I'm not saying anything that anyone hasn't known. If you, for example, if you're an MPO area and you are looking at the downtown area, there may be some parking issues that you don't understand. If you're designing a roundabout, it's important to talk to the motor carrier community because they don't have the same geometrics in turning radius that you do, or that a car might. Also, the freight community can provide you access to data and plans. A lot of people have had trouble using data sources because they don't get down to the very specific either neighborhood or MPO area. You can find that kind of information in talking with the freight community. And finally, not last but not least, the federal regulations for statewide MPO planning require that you involve the and consider freight in the planning process. Okay, getting started. As with any kind of outreach effort you would have, you need to set some goals and objectives. You need to understand what you want to get out of it. Are you working on a project plan? Are you looking at how you would improve an interchange or an intersection? And that would guide the questions you ask. You don't want to waste people's time in asking a lot of questions that, or having focus groups that the information out of it you can't use. Sort of common sense, the same kinds of approach you would take to any public involvement process. You need to identify your stakeholder targets and identify some techniques, and we're going to get into these and the workbook and the workshop and the guidebook go into these and give you a lot of ideas in detail. Who are freight stakeholders? Again, shippers, receivers, carriers, motor carriers, port operators, air cargo carriers, businesses that just about every business is dependent on other businesses. I mean, even if you have a shoe store, you have people shipping in with products to you. So just about any type of business you can think of is a potential freight stakeholder. When to engage the private sector? Certainly, this is mainly about the planning process, but for example, in environmental analysis, I was at a focus group and talking about how freight can impact the environment, and one of the local planners talked about the need to pave truck parking lots because they create a lot of dust. Well, the motor carriers or the trucking company in the group was saying, do you understand the cost of that, and it makes it prohibitive for us to be located in town, which would make it close to their market. So talking with the private sector, with the motor carriers, is important to understand the impacts of your policy decisions at a local level, at a state level, at a regional level. How to engage the private sector? We talk about lots of different ways in the guidebook and the workshop. Informal interactions, which may be an easy way to start for those of you who don't have any kind of formalized facility or formal structure within your organization. Just attending conferences and luncheons with the many private sector freight groups out there is a way to start to learn what freight is all about. There are a number of regional business coalitions, certainly the chambers, many chambers have freight-specific coalitions, they have luncheons, they have educational webinars, and through this you can begin to make some contacts with people, begin to start to build the relationships, to have discussions that can lead to their becoming more engaged with what you do, and you can explain, just like we are in the public sector are trying to understand about freight, they often want to understand how decisions are made and why it takes so long for decisions to be made in the public sector. This slide provides you a list of many groups that are around the country. Now, each state I know has a trucking association up in the left corner. The National Association of Manufacturers have meetings around the country. They have local and regional meetings. The Association of Railroads are in each state. A variety of associations where you can go to have some informal interactions. It's also important to know, if you're going to do a survey, for example, you decide to do a survey of local industries, and or local motor carriers. It is wise, if you want to get a better response, to to go to your American Trucking Association in the state and tell them you're putting the survey out, excuse me, or conducting interviews and ask that they notify their members. We did this with the U.S. Chamber to do a Survey Monkey form of some major industries and major carriers like Walmart and Roadway and Yellow Trucking, and I don't think they would have responded to a survey coming from me or Wilbur Smith or what have you, but the fact that the U.S. Chamber said, we support this interview, we support this survey, can you please respond, this is part of our a study we're doing. So that link back to those associations in your state is important. Knowing how, what to ask and not wasting people's time, asking a lot of questions you're not going to use the answers to is very important. The other thing I wanted to say here is you're more likely to get clear, straight answers if you do more of one-on-one interviews than asking carriers and shippers to come and sit in a great big meeting hall where everybody's together. Nobody wants to give out their competitive advantage. So, you know, while focus groups are good and important, you may find that you get better responses if you're respectful of people's time and you make a phone call or ask for an interview. They may tell you they want to give you, they have to do it over the phone, and be prepared for that. Interview survey technique, certainly develop a discussion guide. Don't just go in there blank. Figure out if you're talking to the right person in the agency so that you get the answers you need. Make sure you let people know that their information will remain anonymous and you're not going to share proprietary information that may reduce their competitiveness. We always tell people to avoid Mondays and Fridays because shipping over the weekend or receiving over the weekend, not everybody's in the office and they're cleaning up or getting ready for the weekend. Another technique to choose, you see gentlemen here and a young lady to interviewing some truckers. We've done intercept surveys. They're highly successful. You need to be respectful of people's times. You can ask just a couple of questions, so knowing exactly what you want is good. We've used these. We did a project recently on I-70 where we stopped close to 1,000 trucks in one day. Nobody was stopped for more than 5 minutes, but we used it to confirm and validate the data we had out of TransSearch and FAB in terms of origins and destinations. What we did is we went to someone who worked at a motor carrier and asked them to help us design that survey so that we were respectful and we knew what questions we could get the answers to. We also went to the motor carrier, the American Trucking Association, and asked them to let their members know that we were asking the questions and it was something they condoned. Other things people do is ATRI has a project with GPS tracking on a lot of the trucks. FHWA has this data and sponsored it. And sometimes people will actually trail the trucks. They'll follow them to see where they're going. Other options are focus groups and freight forums and roundtables and advisory committees. These have been successful. You're going to hear examples of these with the other speakers. They are done in many different ways, whether it's a one-time event. It's important that the private sector find value in them. It's not just to be value for you. Some states and some people do them on an as-need basis for specific projects. Remember, while government timetables are like doing 20-year plans and doing a road that takes you 10 years to do, if you're in the private sector, your turnaround time is a couple of months. You want to see some action. So there's not, it's not that they're not patient with government. It's that they're in business to be in business and make money, and they don't have 10 years to show a profit. You're going to hear after me a number of examples of freight working groups and roundtables and economic development groups that have worked. We've listed a few here. Certainly Minnesota's advisory council has been around probably 20 years, one of the longest, as has DDRPC. The guidebook and the workshop have lots of examples in them of things that have worked and what makes them successful. But you're going to hear some really good examples in the following speakers. The results that you're hoping for by engaging the private sector are that your projects are going to address not only the needs of the passenger cars, but will address the needs of the business sector. It will improve the economic competitiveness of your business. It will. Many of you have seen the MSNBC poll on which states are the most business friendly. This is part of that business friendliness, having that interaction, having that relationship with businesses in your region and your state. I believe, although it's not for me to say, from what I've heard, is businesses welcome talking with state and NPOs and local governments and economic development groups. They want to be heard. You just need to be respectful of their time. And what everyone is looking for are long-term relationships, so you have somebody you can pick up the phone and ask a question to, and maybe don't have to go as far as a focus group, but someone that knows you and trusts you and knows that their input to you will be helpful to you and to them. Here are the links to the guidebook and to the training, and if you want to schedule a workshop, you either need to contact Jocelyn Jones or Carol Keenan. You can download these. I'll leave them up for a minute, or you can contact me, but Jocelyn and Carol schedule these. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Suzanne. Our next presentation will be given by Nicole Katsikidis from the Maryland Department of Transportation. And just as a reminder, the files used during today's presentation are available in the lower right-hand side of the Adobe Connect window. Nicole, you may begin.
Thank you. Is it Carrie? Is there an echo?
Yes, there is.
Okay. Is that better?
Yes. Much better.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Nicole Katsikidis with Maryland Department of Transportation, and I'm joined today with Debbie Bowden from our Office of Freight and Multimodalism, who handles much of our freight policy and motor carrier policy as well, to help me out with our presentation. I'm anxious to give this presentation because we have tried to work very hard to engage the private sector in our freight efforts, and it really all began with our freight planning process. So I'm going to go through today, I'm going to my agenda slide, just talking about our background using the private sector, the benefits of engaging the private sector. I see somebody said it'd be better if I do not use the speakerphone. I'm actually using a different contraption through my computer, so Carrie, it might be better if somebody else goes and then I call back in on a different line.
Let's see, I'm not hearing much background noise right now, but I just heard me come back through. Let's see, do you have your speakers on your computer?
Okay. I will continue then. And I'll monitor the comments. Anyway, I would like to go through our background, the benefits of engaging the private sector, the challenges that we have with that, and future plans that we have for using the private sector, and answer any questions that you may have later on. Okay. Just to give you some context from Maryland, I'd like you to know, obviously you all know where Maryland is, but you can see by the map here, and I realize it's a little blurry, but this is from FHWA's website. You can see where Maryland sits in the context of the freight network, the highway corridors, where we are in between other states on the East Coast. And so it's very important that Maryland reach out and have a good understanding of what the issues are, not just in Maryland, but in our surrounding states. Understanding freight on a regional level, a mega regional level, understanding East Coast freight, and having that input from the private sector. We are part of an extremely busy region of the United States, and so it's really important that we not just think about what's in Maryland, but what's around us as well. Our next map. I just have a few maps to show you, give you some context. And while this map is just of Maryland, you can see that we have some significant corridors, the I-95 corridor, the I-81 corridor, 270 from D.C. out west. And we've got quite a bit going on in terms of various highway corridors as well as rail corridors. We have the Northeast Corridor, which has Norfolk Southern. We have CSX and a number of freight entities on the shore as well. So we're right in the mix of things, which is really important for us to consider what's going on around us and plan appropriately. And here's just a map of manufacturing clusters. That's something that comes out of our statewide freight plan. By looking at this, you can see where the population centers are, and you can see that there's population centers around that manufacturing clusters that pretty much map up where the freight infrastructure is, but there's also some on the shore as well as in Western Maryland and around us in Pennsylvania and such that need to be considered as we do our freight planning and freight outreach. So here is how we have done our private stakeholder engagement. We really began engaging the private sector more formally with the state's first statewide freight plan, and it was our first multimodal plan that incorporated everything we could think of in order to put together something that captured the snapshot of freight in Maryland and also understood where we needed to go. And in order to do that, we really needed to get the private stakeholder engagement. We couldn't just be the state modes, and in Maryland, it's Maryland DOT, and we have our modal administrations, which is State Highway, Maryland Transit Administration, Motor Vehicle, Maryland Port Administration, all underneath. So, Maryland Transportation Authority as well. So we're all working together, and it couldn't just be us putting on paper what we think needs to happen for freight. It had to include the private sector. So what happened was we engage the private sector by creating a freight stakeholder advisory committee. And this freight stakeholder advisory committee was made up of members of the private sector from various entities. We had shippers, we had manufacturers, we had more port-related companies. We even had a few federal representatives from FHWA and Federal Railroad Administration, but we also had Norfolk Southern and CSX participate as well. So with that group, we were able to pull them together and have them as an advisory group to help us with our freight planning effort. And so in doing that, they were able to come to our freight planning sessions, which happened in our MPOs, and we used the MPOs to bring even more stakeholders together, including citizens and groups you might not think of necessarily as freight. We were really trying to, because freight travels on the same infrastructure as a lot of our passenger or transit type activities, we had to include those groups as well. We couldn't just have just freight and shippers and logistics companies. So that group helped us, and the MPOs helped us to get our freight plan out. And now we maintain the Freight Stakeholder Advisory Committee in an advisory role, and we use them for special projects. not advancing. Here we go. Then from that, the Office of Freight Multimodalism has been having freight summits, and that has been an opportunity to get not only our freight stakeholder advisory group, but stakeholders that we've identified during the planning process and throughout the entire state, bringing them all together for a freight summit opportunity to talk about hot topics in freight. And we've had two of those sessions, and the most recent session was in 2009 when we rolled out our freight plan. And it's a pretty massive effort to do because we get hundreds of people that attend. So we are looking to do that next spring, and we're looking at freight and livability and freight and sustainability as the topics. But our freight stakeholders and from the private sector really help drive those agendas because we're trying to be responsive to the freight stakeholders because they are the users, and they need to tell us exactly what we need to do in order to improve what's going on. And we definitely see the link between transportation and economic development and want to have them as our connection to help us understand that much better. And that's why engaging the stakeholders in the planning process has been key for economic development as well. And we're trying to bring together local land use planners, local economic developers, even those people at the state level with the private sector through our activities in order to have those discussions and really understand how transportation investments and freight can improve the freight picture, economic picture overall for not only the state of Maryland but the whole region. We are now using our freight stakeholders that we've identified through the planning process in a number of special projects. Our freight stakeholder members help us with key policy issues. For example, Debbie Bowden, who is also on the line with me and here to help present and answer any questions you may have, recently was able to work with the mill calling industry to resolve some of the problems we were having with overweight trucks who didn't have permits, and also to get a piece of legislation passed that that helped extend the permit program that we have, as well as to advertise it among the freight mill hauler community. And I think that was a very successful project that she went through. We've also been working with the stakeholders on trying to develop a project for the IFTWG, the Freight Technology Working Group, so we can look at some homeland security and also some real-time tracking and communication issues to help with freight movement in the Baltimore region. We have used members of our Freight Stakeholder Advisory Committee to help us with mandatory study that had to be done, a commission that had to be created by our legislature for transportation funding called the Blue Ribbon Commission. And the Blue Ribbon Commission is supposed to identify new and creative mechanisms for funding for transportation. So several of our FSAC members sit on the Blue Ribbon Commission as well. They participate in the Port's MyZod District, and we also have port stakeholder groups where a lot of the stakeholders come together, and so it's our job to make sure we interact with them and participate with those groups and understand what's going on at the port, what's going on in the region, and how we can help. Debbie, would you like to speak to the mill calling policy issues and to some of the other things that you've been working on with the private sector?
Yes, thanks, Nicole. Good afternoon, good morning, everyone. The mill calling policy issue is a great specific example of how outreach really helped us to take care of an issue that has been facing in Maryland for several years. Quick background, milk haulers are known to have more weight than is allowed on their vehicles, and there have been several efforts to expand a heavy hauling truck permitting program.
Excuse me, I think someone might have their phone not on mute. So if you're a presenter and you aren't presenting at this time, if you could please put your phone on mute, that would be great.
Okay. This is Debbie again.
Go ahead and continue, Debbie. I'm not sure exactly what happened there.
Thank you, Carrie. So, as I said, we had this issue with overweight milk haulers coming into our state. It's an issue that we've been trying to resolve for several years. We dealt with multiple agencies, including the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, to regulate the milk hauling itself in the tank. We dealt with the Maryland State Police, our Urban Authority Police. We also dealt with the private sector and the I seem to be taking a lot of time with some of the background noises. So to fast forward to what, how we were able to engage the private sector and solve this issue, earlier this year, we gathered all the parties who are interested in this overarching mill calling and had a meeting and decided what were some of the challenges that we were dealing with enforcement. One of the key elements was that several years ago it had been our understanding that we were not allowed to take enforcement against the mill callers because they would be penalized through the Health and Mental Hygiene Agency for offloading the milk. The milk that was overweight, they would be penalized. Through the conversations we had, through the work groups we had, we learned that was not the issue. The Department of Mental Health and Mental Hygiene said that they encouraged safe operation on Maryland highways, and they developed protocol that if a mill caller is indeed overweight, they can step in to ensure the integrity of the mill is maintained, while at the same time the state police or transportation authority police can take enforcement action as necessary. And that was a great success for Maryland because it allows our highways to be safer. It allows the mill callers to have to know where they stand on the health regulations and the safety regulations. And as Nicole mentioned, it also allowed us to be able to expand a permitting program we have, which will permit the carriers to carry more weight given certain safety configurations of their vehicle. They have to add an extra truck, which helps with the safety again, and also with system preservation. So we would not have been able to get this issue resolved and have the cooperation of the mill callers and the co-ops had it not been for our public outreach in engaging the private sector. Nicole, thank you. I think that's given the time that I was taking with the technology issues, I think I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay, thank you, Debbie. I will go ahead and continue. The OFM also participates in a number of private sector groups, such as the Council for Supply Chain Management, the Delmarva Water Transport Committee on the Eastern Shore, the Maryland Motor Truck Association, and Baltimore-Port O'Malley forecast what needs to happen or to also use that information to quantify benefits. And we don't have a lot of funding to do various projects, so now we're relying ever more on the private sector to help us through T3, but we can't quite make things happen that we want to see happen. Our freight plan, for example, was put out in 2009, and we are still trying to address almost every project in there. And also the metropolitan area is a bit fragmented for us. I mean, we are dealing with lots of different states. Freight crosses our borders. We've got, freight doesn't stop at the county border or the city border. It crosses a number of different borders. And so we're pretty stretched out. And it's a little bit tough to understand all of the issues that need to go in there. I'd like to also just quickly, some legal issues. We just the other day are trying to do some work in identifying rail-served properties around the Port of Baltimore, and we weren't able to get as much information as we wanted to about the condition of the rail to understand how we could help it. So we need to ask the company, the owners of the rail-served properties. And one of the challenges is that any information they give us is subject to the Public Information Act. And so we have to be very upfront about that. And I think the earlier speaker said develop a script. We have to do that too. And we've run it through legal. So we've encountered some legal challenges with trying to get the information that we need just to help the freight community. Our future plans include enhancing and strengthening our FSAC and continuing the freight summit as much as we can. also maybe doing smaller venues for specific topics. We'll continue our policy role in engaging the private sector, and MDOT will continue to participate in private sector groups in order to get the word out about what our efforts are and try to understand what the freight, what our stakeholders are doing. And if there's any questions on our processes or our freight planning efforts or some specific policy areas that Debbie's been working on or other people from our offices, please do not hesitate to contact me. I'd be happy to help.
Thanks so much, Nicole and Debbie. Appreciate it. Our next presentation will be given by Karen Schmidt from the Freight Mobility Strategic Investment Board. Karen, you may begin.
Thank you. And I'll offer my apologies for my voice, and I have a lot of text in some of the slides because I wasn't sure I was going to even have a voice today. The Freight Mobility Board was created in 1998. My next page here. We're going to talk, first of all, about what the Freight Mobility Strategic Investment Board is, how the fifth-step process works, and then give you some examples of projects that we've been working on. We were created in 1998, and we were specifically created as an independent agency to look at the freight movement in our state and to also engage the private sector in planning and also in financial participation in the projects. We are a standalone agency, and we have a 12-member board governing us. The representation is shown on the screen here, so I don't need to read that to you, but we rely on the private sector, which includes ports, because ports in our state are now investing in projects off of port property, and the county and city folks, as well as the DOT folks, are the ones that come up with the projects and make the applications, but we require them to go back through the private sector and make sure that these projects are ones that are supported by the freight mobility movers and also by the people who are going to help pay for it. So the board guides the agency's strategic plan. They evaluate and score every project application that comes to us. They advocate for funding, including advocating for funding as part of an overall package when their own funds are going to be tapped, as with the truckers, and the truckers have been very good partners at saying, we're willing to be part of a solution, but we want to see our funds go to freight so that we have a return on what we're paying for. We operate as an unbiased broker because we don't own any of the real estate. We are not part of any of the movement of freight groups. We're competitively neutral. We develop agreements and funding shares. It's always interesting to have the truckers and the railroads sitting together and agreeing on what projects should move forward and what the benefits are to both. We advise the governor and the legislature of freight trends and concerns. Our jurisdictional partners are the ones who submit projects for evaluation, but it goes both ways. Sometimes the local governments or DOT will submit a project, and sometimes the private sector will come to us and say, we see a need, can you talk to the local jurisdiction and see if they would be interested in partnering on a project. The projects must principally benefit from freight, rather than general mobility. They need to be on a state or a regional plan, and we prefer them to be on both. They must have multiple financial partners. We are targeting the strategic freight corridors, and the definition of our strategic freight corridors is on the screen. We operate with a project list that covers about a six-year period where we are bringing projects through the process and getting them into a construction phase. And we found that less than 6 years is difficult to get projects into construction with permitting, right-of-way acquisition, et cetera. More than 6 years is difficult to hold the partnerships together, and certainly when we're dealing with private sector funding, that is a window that's way too large to go beyond 6 years. As I said, the state, city, county, and port may submit projects, but sometimes those projects are first submitted by the private sector. Again, we're competitively neutral as far as jurisdictions. We're blind to jurisdictions. Freight doesn't care if it's on a city street, a county road, or a state highway. It normally has to travel on a multitude of different types of highways in various jurisdictions. And we're also blind to the modes because most freight has to go on more than one mode. And we need to fix all of the modes, not just one over another. Partnerships are required statutorily here in Washington. And so we take our task very seriously in putting our partnerships together and going out and seeking unique ways of engaging other partners to participate in our projects. Projects are evaluated, as I said, by both the board, and they all read every single application. And we also have a tech team, and our tech team includes the Washington Trucking Association, the Washington Public Ports Association, PMSA, the Pacific Maritime Shipping Association, and both of the railroads that serve our state. We have a 198-point criteria, which is our quantitative analysis, but we have found that is good enough just to select projects by using a application and scoring grid, because there are some excellent grant writers out there with projects that are not particularly strong in the freight area. We have also found that there are a lot of grant writers who have a great project but don't present it in a way that scores very well. So after we go through the initial project evaluation, part of this is also where the private sector portion of our board and the tech team will go out specifically to whatever region or whatever area or city the project is in, and they will talk to local carriers in that area to get a hands-on feel for the benefits of the project and whether the proposed solution for whatever we're trying to solve will actually be successful. The teams confer after scoring, and the high-scoring projects then meet with the teams. We have a one-day face-to-face meeting where they're given a series of questions that have come up after we read the applications and discuss them. If we have additional questions, those are sent out directly to the project sponsors. They're asked to come to the meeting with the answers to those questions and any others that may come up. Here's our 198-point scoring grid. It is focused on freight. It took a year to develop this with all of the freight players at the table coming up with a balance so that a rail project and a road project or a port project would all score evenly across this grid. It has proven to be successful in the 13 years we've used it. The final recommendations are developed, and then those recommendations are then sent to the full board where they're adopted. In an open meeting, project sponsors are advised ahead of time what the recommendation is, so if they have anything they wish to add or any additions they would like to add, any requests for additional funding, they can make it at that time. At the time the project is adopted, there's a dollar value and a percentage assigned. FIPSIP by statute cannot increase participation after this point. If the project costs go up, the dollar value is used on the project. If the project costs go down, the percentage is used on the project. We've worked with our partners all the way through the process, developing and nurturing partnerships and bringing on additional partners to our process. We assist with permitting and by having early involvement on the part of not only the private sector, the public sector, but also the private sector, it does help us with permitting, like, for instance, with the railroads and some of the port issues. We assist with right-of-way acquisitions, and we spend more time than I would like to mention brokering agreements and keeping agreements held together, because when you do have a diverse group of partners, it is sometimes interesting to try to hold those partnership agreements. The legislature has kept current on the status of the projects, and we do keep their money moving because they don't like to see money sitting around. Funding approval for construction is granted by the legislature after we identify the projects that we're going to be using, and they approve of our final budget. From that point, the projects have 12 months to enter construction. We have quarterly reporting that is required, and it's tracked by both the House and Senate committees, as well as by OFM. If projects are not moving through the process where they are going to be able to make their timelines, if they're not getting their partnerships put together, and if they're not getting their permitting or right-of-way acquired, then they will be removed for lack of activity, and we'll move on to another project. We encourage unique approaches. We had a situation where DOT had a project that they were going to build in Southwest Washington. It was an expansion of an off-ramp where they were going to add another lane, and by getting the local truckers involved, we were able to do some demonstrations on the ramp. It shows that the addition of a ramp lane was not going to be as productive as simply doing a double pulsing of the traffic signal. So it saved money and had a much better outcome, and the truckers, I think, felt that they made a difference in that decision. We do have groundbreakings and ribbon cuttings, not only to continue to keep our legislative and congressional partners involved in their projects, but also to give recognition to our partners who have come together to make sure that projects get built, because it's not just one agency spending money to build them. We offer cash flow flexibility so that if it's necessary for us to be the first in or the last in, we can have that flexibility to make sure projects can move forward. We show cash flow accountability. Obviously, our legislature is very interested in that, as well as OFM, and so in our quarterly reports, they see how our cash flow is flowing. We do offer a nimble response because we're a very small agency focused on one goal, and that is the movement of freight. I'm sorry for the size of this one, but as I said, I was afraid I was going to lose my voice. I wanted to give a couple of examples. We have Edgar Martinez Way right by our baseball stadium, and Royal Broome, which is on the other side of our baseball stadium. And we were trying to build a direct access from the port area, from our rail yards down by the port area up to I-5 and I-90. We have very limited connections because of our geography, and this became a very critical choke point. The original agreement was not honored by the City of Seattle, and so we had to work together with everyone to come up with a new alignment to fix this problem. The secondary alignment that was proposed had a flawed design, and we had to go back with our partners, both our financial partners as well as our additional allies that came together to work with DOT and the City of Seattle to come up with an alignment that was actually going to work and not create a choke point farther down the line. Everyone was in agreement. It was a very successful outcome, and it would not have been as successful had we not had a lot of participation from various partners. In Eastern Washington, we had a project in a small community called Prosser, Washington. And in that community, they had a number of problems. They had a substandard rail bridge where trucks couldn't go under the bridge. They had a bridge that was over the river outside of Prosser and on this one single route through town, and the bridge was functionally obsolete, so trucks were not able to go over that. And then we had to redesign a corner to their manufacturing center, as well as a couple of the businesses where the trucks were having difficulty making their turn. They had a limited number of dollars, and so we worked with a number of the businesses that would be beneficiaries, and those beneficiaries came together with contributions, and as you can see, we had a number of private sector donors that helped create a match for this project. Our third example, the Kent Valley is the second largest warehouse area on the West Coast, and we have a number of problems trying to get east-west connections out of the valley up to the interstate and over to both of our ports of Seattle and Tacoma. We're building a corridor that involves both a roadway extension up to I-5 and two grade separations. To put the financial partners together, we worked with the warehouse owners, and by using an LID and the agreement of warehouse owners, they agreed to pay one-third of the cost of this project. So we're able to have a lot of success in moving this project ahead. We found that there's a greater willingness to participate in financing some of these projects when they're directly involved in the decision-making. The consensus building decision-making has been successful in keeping both the railroads and the truckers and others at the table working together to solve problems. We understand that freight does not start or end on the state system, and so the entire corridor has to work before we're happy that the corridor is going to be beneficial for freight. The funding flexibility has been very key to keeping some of these projects moving. And we've experienced private sector support for new revenue if part is directed to freight, and the trucking community has been very successful in helping us develop our budget, and also in providing input. And when we talk about various projects, we will go to the Washington Trucking Association, explain what we need. They will not only internally work on an answer for us for a specific project need, but they'll also go out and reach out to their own members and come back with an answer, which is a lot of help for us in not having to have a lot more outreach, because they're helping provide that outreach. And we have found that freight mobility improvement is more successful when those projects are identified by the private sector. They know where the choke points are, they know where the problems are, and we, on a regular basis, do stay in contact with the ports, with the truckers, and with the railroads, and have them help us in identifying where problem areas are, and then we work with that jurisdiction to see if we can develop a partnership and fix the problem. It also creates easier coordination between private and jurisdictional partners when they're involved right from the beginning. If they feel ownership of a project, they're more willing to help with permitting and also with helping solve problems that come up in the course of putting a project together. Direct private sector involvement has been key to our program. Project selection by an unbiased board has been respected and has been very successful. Our ability to bring partners and funds together and the ability to also phase projects as we have money available so that we can continue to move projects to completion even if we have to divide it in various phases. And we do have been successful in leveraging funds. We currently leverage about $5 for every $1 of program money that we put in. And if you have any questions, this is how you get a hold of me or our FIMSIP website. You can go on the website and also see our quarterly reports, and those are pretty descriptive of where the projects stand and how money is being spent. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Our final presentation will be given by Liz DeRucci from the New Jersey Transportation Planning Authority. Liz, you may begin.
Thank you. As Kari mentioned, I currently manage the air quality conformity process in our region, and in addition to that, I manage a new proactive air quality program that we call the TCAM program, and TCAM simply stands for Transportation Clean Air Measures. Today, I'm happy to share with you a living example of a very successful TCAM public-private partnership that the NJTPA embarked upon with the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey, and the CSX and Norfolk Southern Railroads. And I just, if someone could refresh my memory about advancing. Oh, I've got it, advancing my slide. There we go. Okay. First of all, I just wanted to tell you a little bit about who we are. We're the fourth largest MPO in the nation. We cover northern and central New Jersey. We're home to 6.6 million people. There are 3.2 million jobs in our region. We encompass 4,200 square miles. And we have 13 counties and two large cities in our region, as well as 384 municipalities. So partnerships are very important to us. We have a large, complex, and very busy transportation network in our region. There's a map here that just shows you where we are. We're very close to New York City on the right of your screen. The state of New York to our north, and Pennsylvania to the west, and then southern New Jersey, of course, to the south of us. We have 23,000 miles of road network, over 250 bus routes. We have a 10-line commuter rail system that stretches 390 miles with 150 stations. We have 14 miles of rapid transit and 15 miles and growing of light rail lines, 18 ferry routes, 58,000 park and ride spots, 4,800 roadway bridges, and 600 rail bridges. We have airports, intercity buses, rail, and three crossings to Manhattan, the George Washington Bridge, and the Holland and Lincoln Tunnels. In addition, of course, we have sidewalks, bike paths, paratransit, and for all you freight people in the audience, we're the largest Atlantic container port. We handle 400 million tons of freight by truck and 25 million tons of freight by rail each year. This just gives you a sense of who we are and what we do. And the engine TPA does many things. We bring together traditional and non-traditional stakeholders with an interest in transportation. We provide technical resources and information to support transportation planning in our region. Specifically, we create a vision to meet the mobility needs of our region. We develop a long-range plan to improve and manage the transportation system. Our plan right now goes out to 2035. And we also prioritize more than $2 billion of federal funds annually to support transportation planning and projects in our region. I think I'm getting ahead of the slides here. Oh, here we go. Okay. In our long-range plan, which I mentioned goes out to 2035 right now, we update that every 4 years. We have identified six regional goals. This is really the essence of what we do and what we're striving to do here in New Jersey. Number one, and these are in no particular order, we protect and improve the quality of the natural ecosystem and the human environment. So that's an environmental goal for us. We provide affordable, accessible, dynamic transportation systems that are responsive to current and future customers. We retain and increase economic activity and competitiveness. We strive to enhance system coordination, efficiency, and intermodal connectivity. We maintain a safe and reliable transportation system in a state of good repair. And we select transportation investments that support the coordination of land use with transportation systems. And you'll see that this particular project I'm going to talk about does tie in and touches on a number of these goals, not just environmental, but economic, et cetera, et cetera. I'll give you a little bit of background on the Transportation Clean Air Measures Project first. In 2007, the NJTPA embarked on a project to identify and analyze Transportation Clean Air Measures, TCAMs, that were not being generated through existing programs and that would benefit air quality and support the environmental and livability goals of the NJTPA. TCAMs also respond directly to federal guidance regarding the use of CMEC funds under Safety Lou. Prior to this, our work in air quality had been concerned with the conformity determination and meeting the federal regulations of the Clean Air Act only. The NJTPA wanted to be much more proactive in improving air quality in our region, above and beyond just meeting the budgets for the criterion pollutants, which we have to look at, NOx, VOCs, carbon, and particulate matter 2.5, and in advance of anticipated legislation for other emissions such as greenhouse gases. The project was specifically designed to augment existing environmentally beneficial programs as well as to advance new and innovative initiatives. Identified in-house. It was something that we decided at the MPO that we wanted to do. We thought this would be beneficial. So in 2007, the MPO identified this as a study they wanted to undertake. The study was identified and a consultant team was selected. After this, a technical advisory group was formed. In this particular case, the effort was guided by a comprehensive technical advisory committee, originally with representatives from NJDEP, the Department of Environmental Protection, NJDOT, Department of Transportation, NJ Transit. Now, the RTAC is our regional representatives from those 13 counties and two cities I mentioned earlier, and the TMAs, the Transportation Management Associations. Since those early stages, the Technical Advisory Committee, which does continue to meet, has expanded to include EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey, and the surrounding MPOs. We now work with NFTIC, DVRPC, and SJTPO as well. Originally, the TAC provided technical experience and helped to select and prioritize the final shortlisted TCAMs. Today, the TAC is instrumental in facilitating their implementation. This effort has seen us develop new and exciting working partnerships with agencies that we traditionally had not worked with in the past, and saw us roll up our shirt sleeves and work together in a closer, more dedicated and focused fashion with our traditional partners. There were four types of TCAMs that were investigated. The first type dealt with clean vehicle technology, and this is the TCAM that I'll be talking about today. The second group of TCAMs was measures to reduce VMT vehicle miles traveled. The third were anti-idling measures, and the fourth were public education and outreach initiatives. A total of 52 TCAMs were originally identified and screened based on the qualitative and quantitative criteria, and in particularly the emissions reductions for the criterion pollutants, NOx, VOCs, PM2.5, and CO, as well as the greenhouse gases. From this original list, 20 candidate TCAMs were prioritized and investigated further. Fact sheets were developed, and 20 TCAMs were considered further. Each of these was researched more diligently and screened again more rigorously, both qualitatively and quantitatively. And finally, the group came up with a set of 9 TCAMs that they felt were priorities for the NJTPA, and they felt that these could be developed into action plans. So we are currently implementing, of the 9 action plans, we've currently had success with 5 to date. And a point I wanted to make for this particular webinar is the key to success of this project was really to establish and nurture those key partnerships as early as possible. Involving people who you think may be implementing your efforts later, including them on the TAC at the very beginning. You can never involve a potential, you know, partner too early. So now we're talking about forming the technical working group. This was a key step in successfully implementing the TCAMs further down the line. We may not have been aware of it at the time, but that's how it turned out later. The TAC was instrumental in doing the following, in helping select the consultant team, in guiding the project, of course providing the technical expertise because this was a rather technical undertaking, and helping to select and prioritize the final TCAMs. At the outset of the project, I think that was what was envisioned for the Technical Advisory Committee. As time has passed and we have more experience under our belt, we came to realize that many of the people on the TAC became implementers of the final action plans. So probable implementers, initially we included US EPA, DEP, DOT, Transit, and the TMAs. You could argue that those are our traditional partners. And as we progressed, we expanded our TAC and now includes the Port Authorities, New York, New Jersey, the Turnpike Authority, the Department of Education, Conrail, the Motor Truckers Association, the New Jersey Rail Carriers Association. We continue to add new partners as opportunities develop. Now, this particular public-private partnership was a program to retrofit or replace diesel locomotive engines for freight. The NJTPA had an action plan from our TCAM study that recommended promoting and funding the retrofit or replacement of diesel locomotives for freight. The benefits were quantitative and qualitative. They were very tangible. They were easy to identify. Quantitative benefits were reducing the VOCs, the NOx, the PM2.5, the greenhouse gases, and we could measure the reduction with the changes in technology, reducing noise levels. There were also some sort of spin-off qualitative benefits that we hadn't maybe initially identified, but came to find out and be able to implement as well, and that was responding to the community concerns. And reducing fuel consumption and extending engine life as well. We looked for existing opportunities. Rather than take these TCANs and try and implement them all by ourselves, starting at zero, we looked around the region to see what else was going on. At the same time, the Port Authority had just developed a comprehensive clean air strategy, and its purpose was to reduce emissions in advance of regulations. For rail, the Port Authority had identified replacing 5 switching locomotives with M-sets, and this initiative tied in perfectly with our TCAM initiative. So initially, the NJTPA had discussions with the Port Authority. Both agencies agreed that this project shared mutual goals and that it would be beneficial for the region overall. At this point, both agencies agreed to commit funds and staff to implement the project. The Port Authority then reached out to CSX and Norfolk Southern and gained financial and staff commitments from them as well. We've talked about leveraging funds. The money we had for the TCAM effort was modest. So we certainly benefited from leveraging funds. We used that money not just as a minimal match, but we leveraged as much as we could. In this case, you can see the respective contributions on the slide. The Port Authority kicked in $600,000. Each railroad kicked in $300,000, and we kicked in $1.8 million. And that allowed us to fund the replacement of 2 engines. Now, the NJTPA also, with this program, sought out projects that will complement other similar efforts. I think I mentioned earlier that the Port Authority had identified 5 locomotives in Port Newark, Elizabeth, that needed to be retrofitted. Because our resources were limited, this public-private partnership between the Port Authority and the NJTPA and the railroads was only able to support the retrofit of 2 locomotives. However, the other 3 retrofits were done concurrently by the railroads and the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. So all 5 locomotives were able to be replaced, but they're using different agreements and different pots of money. The NJTPA began this, just let me catch up on the slide here. Okay, engaging other agencies can be enhanced. Well, the NJTPA began discussions with the Port Authority in 2009. Involving other agencies as early as possible so that the project is known, understood, and seen favorably. In hindsight, we may have engaged the Port Authority in 2007 when we began the TCAM project, but, you know, crystal balling, we didn't know what the results would be, so we caught up with them later. Highlighting the benefits of the project are important when you're engaging other people, other agencies, qualitative, quantitative benefits, and also creating an energy or a buzz about the project is very helpful as well. People are more apt it's better to have people involved in a project because they want to be involved, not because they have to be involved. And if there's an energy or a buzz and it's something new and it's exciting, it's easier to get support that way. So that's kind of a PR piece, but that's important too, something that can be done. Securing a commitment, a firm commitment from the agencies is important. And I think the number one factor is securing a financial commitment. Regardless of how small the dollar amount is, any kind of financial commitment really puts people on the line. They bring money to the table, and suddenly there's a line item in their budget that they have to be accountable for. So I think if you can get any kind of a financial commitment from people, that really, from agencies, from groups, participants, that really says a lot. Also the commitment of staffing resources as well. It was intensive in terms of forming a working group and stick-handling the project through. And so you really need dedicated people, people who are really going to stay with you throughout the project, who aren't going to drop the ball, and I think who really believe in the project as well. So having a firm staffing resource commitment is really important as well. And the other thing we requested for our board, of course, were resolutions or letters of support from the other agencies. We had to have in writing that they were committed to this project in order for our board to take action and approve the allocation, make that allocation of $1.8 million. In terms of the project management itself, very common sense approach, identifying the overall project team and having a key person from each agency who is responsible for the project. That's critical. Identifying a project timeline with specific tasks, deadlines, and who is responsible. And the importance of meeting regularly in person or via conference call to discuss the progress and resolve issues. Things came up. This was something new we'd never done before. Things came out of left field quite frequently. It was really important to stay in touch. And even though we did meet regularly in person, we had many conference calls in between, many email chains and so on, that really kept this project on track. This is my room, one that built in a day squad. Private partnerships could also be called patience and perseverance. In 2007, we undertook the TCAM study. In 2009, we met with the Port Authority to discuss possibly implementing this diesel retrofit project. In 2009, we gained solid commitment from the Port Authority, CSX, and Norfolk Southern in terms of the financial commitment, the staff commitment, and letters of support. In 2010, the NJTPA Board of Trustees recommended funding for the project, and the FHWA approved the project, and delivery is scheduled for December of 2011 for those two retrofitted locomotives. So it was a long haul, but it was certainly worth it. And this is my contact information. If people have questions online, of course, I'm here now. And if you want to contact me either over the phone or through email, please feel free to.
Thank you so much, Liz. I'd now like to